Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silken at Edinburgh. I'm joined as always by Frank Cagliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm great, David. I'm great. Thank you very much. How are you?
I'm doing well. So we've had now,
Happy Valentine's Day.
Happy Valentine's. We are recording this on Valentine's Day afternoon, and happy Valentine's Day to our loved ones who my wife doesn't listen to the podcast. Yours does though. So
yes, but she only listens to make sure I don't bully you too much. So really, that's her gift to you.
Oh, well, excellent. Okay. So now we've now had two Democratic contests for the nomination. We've had the caucuses in Iowa that we talked about a couple weeks ago.
And the results are still trickling in.
Yes, the never-ending caucuses. And the primary in New Hampshire. And it appears as if the current front runner, although it's a very convoluted picture, is Bernie Sanders, the senator from Vermont who identifies as a Democratic socialist. And so what we thought we'd talk about today is the history of socialism in the United States, and particularly about how to sort of contextualize Bernie's identification as a socialist in the electoral and political processes. So if we want to find what Bernie's antecedents are, Frank, where should we start?
Well, I think we should start with a question, David.
Okay.
A very famous question, which I'm sure you're familiar with. In 1906, a German sociologist named Werner Sombart asked a question, which has become a kind of staple for graduate students in the United States.
In fact, I think I wrote an essay in graduate school using this as a jumping-off point.
And his question was, why is there no socialism in the United States? And everybody has to read this essay. It's a very interesting question. I would, and I think this podcast will question the premise of that question, the assertion that there is no socialism in the United States. If anything, there is a long history of socialism in the United States. And I think we need to, that's what we want to consider today. But in answer to your question, I think if we want to look at the history and the roots of socialism in America, we need to go back to the early 19th century,
okay.
Really.
Well, then, what was Sombart's answer as to why there was no socialism? Because he's writing this in 1906. Socialism is fairly prevalent in most parts of Europe at that time. He's looking at the United States and he's not seeing it. I'm not sure whether he was looking in all the right places, because I think there was lots of socialism in the
United States.
That's sort of the apex of socialism in the United States in some ways is right now during the Progressive Era. But what's his answer?
Well, his answer, among others, is in part it's an indictment of the labor movement in the United States, because he's critical of the fact that labor unions in the United States, which were very prevalent in 1906 and had millions of members, were trade unions that were focused on issues of pay and conditions rather than changing the system. They weren't revolutionary. Secondly, there's a criticism of the American dream, and I don't think it was Sombart, it was a later commentator who basically said, you know, roast beef was the reason there was no
socialism.
Is that Sombart? It's been a while since I read.
On the shoals of roast beef and apple pie, socialist utopias are sent to their doom.
Right, so it's basically, the standard of living is too good in America, so workers weren't going to overthrow the system because they had access to roast beef and apple pie.
Yeah, so, okay. And part of that's about because the labor union, part of that's about sort of, you know, the availability of labor and the ways in which, in some ways, workers had it better, at least some workers had it better, potentially, in the United States than other places.
Oh, it's worth observing, and one of the great socialist books in American history was also published in 1906, Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, which tells you how American workers got their beef.
And it's
not a very good story. So industrialized meat packing is partially explains that. But Sombart's larger issue and larger argument, I think, is basically the American, I'm bolderizing it, but the American dream ruined socialism in America because the working class in America didn't believe they were working class because they believed in social mobility and that social mobility was available to them. And therefore that undermined the sense of class solidarity, which is the basis of a socialist movement.
Sure. Okay. So, let's go back to the origins.
What in your essay in graduate school, what did you think of Sombart's argument? There is some merit to it.
Yeah, I think there is some merit to it. I think some of it has to do with, you know, the labor movement in the United States was fractured in various ways between trade unions for skilled workers and then labor organizations that try to incorporate for a wider segment of the population. I think the mobility of the American workforce had something to do with it. The particular angle I was interested in was the sort of mobility of the American labor force in the 19th century and the extent to which community identity along class lines was jeopardized or undermined by that. But I think the efforts by American corporations working with government were quite skillful in demonizing the labor movement and undermining its effectiveness and delegitimizing it.
And as we'll talk about probably in the next few minutes, sure. I expect, they also deployed a huge amount of violence.
Yes. That's part of what I was, yes.
To prevent labor from organizing. So there were kind of structural problems, let's say.
that's the polite
but
way of
talking. Anyway, and looking at the origins, I think we have to go back, as we have many times, to the Second Great Awakening.
Of course, that is the origins of all things.
Of the 1820s and 30s. So it's the origin of lots of social reform movements, but among those social reform movements were utopian movements. Mm. Now, one can argue, and indeed Marx did, you can't actually have socialist movements unless you have industrialization, and you reach a certain level of the working class has to be a certain size and so on. And industrialization was really taking off in the United States in the 1820s and 30s at the same time that the Second Great Awakening was ongoing, and you got kind of lots of religious and social reform movements, and some of them are quirky and crazy, and some of them...
Like the Oneida Colony.
Yeah, exactly, and the Owenites, and so on. And so you get these sort of utopian movements that are seeking to reform the excesses they see in America, often looking at slavery as a case, but also reforming some of the excesses to be seen as industrialization was taking off in the United States. And so I think we get precursors to socialism in the 1820s and 30s that are kind of unique and homegrown. One of the reasons, again, Sombart is a German asking that question in 1906, so his interpretation of socialism was very much a European, in fact, a Western European conception, and the United States is different. The local environment is different, and that matters. Socialism really starts to spread in the United States, I think, after the Civil War, your period, but it gets an infusion, if you will, it germinates around the middle of the century, especially after the revolutions in Europe in 1848, when there's an influx of German migrants in particular, many of whom have been revolutionaries or have been imbued with those failed revolutions of 1848. And of course, many of these people can be described now as Marxists because Marx is writing and publishing in the 1840s and 50s. And Marx's ideas will take off amongst and will be brought to America by many migrants, especially Germans and German speakers from Central Europe. And they will energize if the utopians of the Second Great Awakening are really the prehistory of socialism, I think the kind of the real history of the origin story are these migrants in the middle of the century. Would you agree
with that? Yes, I mean, like one of the most, there are a number of immigrants who really become the founders of various socialist movements, and probably one of the more interesting to me is Victor Berger, who is from Milwaukee. He was born in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, but he moves to the United States, establishes a newspaper, he has a German language newspaper, and later he has an English language newspaper. He supposedly is the guy who gave Eugene Debs a copy of Marx when Debs was in prison the first time, was one of the proponents for disseminating socialist ideas in the United States through his newspaper and other means. He's the first socialist elected to Congress in 1910, but like lots of socialists, doesn't fare very well during the First World War. He gets elected to Congress, and the Congress refuses to seat him because of his opposition to the war. So there are lots of of German speaking people who are really critical to the development of socialism in the United States and its various incarnations.
What role, David, does, you know, looking at you as a Civil War historian, what role does the Civil War play in this story, do you think, if any?
Oh, that's an interesting question.
It's the turning point for everything in American history.
History, you know, to be sure. It's the pivot for all things. There's both sort of some tangential relationships and sort of more structural ones. One of the things that is happening is you are having, obviously, this is not very long after the 48 Revolution, so you do have a huge number of German-Americans who become American during the Civil War, right? That this is the process of fighting in the Civil War is what makes them into Americans and then tries to sort of infuse their identity as Americans with their identity as Germans and identity as people who are interested in socialist movements. It's really in the aftermath of the Civil War that you get widespread industrialization. Obviously, you have the growth in the market before the Civil War, but the kinds of large industrial factories that you see, that we sort of associate with industrialization, really come to the fore in the decades after the Civil War. And especially, we have the rise of enormous railroads during the Civil War era and immediately afterwards. Some of the earliest strikes are on railroads. We can think about the railroad strikes in the 1870s, throughout the 1880s, and then culminating in the Pullman strike in 1894. And I think some of those are tied pretty directly to the Civil War. Some of the people who are then used to sort of fight the socialists movement and various labor organizations are also tied to the Civil War. The Pinkerton's agency, Pinkerton himself was a spy during the Civil War, and then he sort of uses that experience to establish what is a private army and investigatory detective agency, you can call it. It serves multiple functions. To suppress
Legion too.
That as well, yes. I'm not quite sure how exactly that fits into his particular identity.
Just throwing it in there.
Okay. No, don't want to cast any aspersions on our neighbors to the...
We're from Edinburgh. We do want to cast.
Nice, Frank.
Kidding.
But the Civil War generation is an extraordinarily mobile generation of people. And I think that kind of mobility... I think it's connected with the kinds of dislocations that happened in the late 19th century that lead to the development of the socialist identities. And I must say, identities there because there are multiple competing versions of socialism in the late 19th century.
Yes, I was hoping, I'm hoping we're not actually going to be deconstructing the different and defining the different sects of socialism, which is a bit like talking about religious sects.
I think one of the things that happens...
You'd like to.
Well, only slightly. I won't get into the weeds about this, mostly because I'm not sure I understand all the weeds. But, socialism, when people talk about it in the 19th century context, is very different than socialism after the Russian Revolution, where it becomes a much clearer and more identifiably... problematic ideology for many Americans. I think there are lots of Americans...
State ownership of the means of production and running the economy.
Whereas, there are descriptions of people going to socialist meetings in the United States, in Chicago, in the 1890s, and they're expecting to have, rabble-rousers, and they go up and they, hear people sort of debating finer points of ideology. And as many fights between socialists over what it is they wanted to accomplish and how they were supposed to do it than anything else.
And we get the rise after the Civil War. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're right, David. It's very much focused around the railroads. I mean, the industrialization is driven by the railroads to a large extent. At risk of making a horrible pun, the railroad is the engine of industrialization.
They were the largest employers in the country.
And the biggest corporations and what have you. And it's incredibly dangerous work, either building railroads or working on railroads, and that results in a lot of labor strife and agitation among workers for improved working conditions. So we see the emergence after the Civil War of a number of labor unions and labor organizations, and there are kind of, if you will, two competing models. And this is the background that Sombart was talking about by 1906. So you get the groups like the Knights of Labor, founded in the late 1860s, right?
1869, right. I think.
And the International Workers of the World. In
the 20th century. Yeah.
But the Wobblies, as they're known, who want one big union. They want an organization that encompasses all workers, as opposed to trade and craft unions, which are focused on particular professions or particular industries, who are tend to be focused on paying conditions.
And there's all kinds of ways in which...
The eight-hour day, safety.
Yeah, yeah. And there's all kinds of ways in which race and gender factor into this.
Of course,
this,
yeah.
As you can imagine. But with regards to the railroads, I mean, the railroads and railroad strikes gives us the first really nationally prominent socialist leader in Eugene Debs,
yes.
who was the founder and leader of the American Railroad Railway Union that organizes the Pullman strike in 1894, the brief version of which is Pullman Palace Car Company manufactured these fancy train cars. They had an entire town where they manufactured them in Pullman, Illinois. There's a depression that hits the country in 1893. Pullman, George Pullman, the guy who owned the town and the factory, decides to cut wages but doesn't cut the rent he charges his employees, and so a lot of them are sort of squeezed by that. They go on strike. The American Railway Union launches a nationwide strike on any car that any train that has a Pullman car on it, which is most of them. The government cracks down on that. They put mail cars on all the trains, so they accuse Debs of interfering with the delivering of the mail, and Debs is thrown in jail. But it's sort of a signal of, you know, it's one of these huge labor uprisings that sort of nationalizes the labor movement in the 1890s. Debs at that point was not yet a socialist, but in jail he basically becomes a socialist. He sort of recognizes that sort of working within established political structures and working through traditional skilled unions wasn't going to really win the kinds of battles he wanted to fight. And Debs becomes the socialist candidate for president. He runs five times, I think. And he does 1900, 1904, 1908, 1912. Then he took an election cycle off. And then in 1920. And he gets as much as 6% of the vote.
He gets 6% in 1912 and has the highest vote total for any socialist. Bernie got 13 million votes in running for the Democratic nomination, but obviously he wasn't running in the general election back in 2016. But Debs got over 913,000 votes in 1920 when he was running from jail.
Yeah, so there's two things that are interesting about that his election that his run that year. One is that he was in jail, and so he's not actually like technically eligible to be president, or because he was a felon. But he said he would pardon himself once he got if he got elected.
That's a Trump move.
Yeah, Donald, if you're listening, can't do. But also, that's the first election in which women could vote.
Right.
And so he actually gets more votes than he had gotten when he ran in 1912, but a smaller percentage because of the size of the electorate. Anyway.
One thing I want to observe, David, and this, I think, warrants commentary because of the current election or ongoing contest.
Hmm.
You mentioned Wisconsin. Debs... You know, the Pullman strike starts in Illinois. Debs is buried in Indiana.
Yeah.
There's a real Midwestern flavor to American socialism in the early 20th century. We're going to get congressmen from Wisconsin.
Three socialist mayors of Milwaukee.
Right.
Who's it? Wayne's World. There's a comment about that. Never mind.
Alice
Cooper mentions that in Wayne's World, if you're
you're our pop culture maven, David.
Okay.
The point being, you know, Pete Buttigieg, in part to counter Bernie Sanders, has been suggesting that he represents heartland values, and he's used that phrase about the heartland as opposed to Washington And I think that it bears thinking about that the early socialist history of America, well, it certainly doesn't exclude the major cities on either coast, is really concentrated on the Midwest.
Well, it is. There's a bunch of socialist mayors during the Progressive Era. They're mostly in Wisconsin and Minnesota and Ohio, and in mining towns in Colorado.
Yes.
But there are dozens of them, and you know, I think some of them, like the ones in Wisconsin or ones in Milwaukee, are sort of feeding off this German ideology and dissent. But you know, if you look at sort of the policies that are put in place by those communities and states during the Progressive Era, and some of which are still around, they have sort of the hallmark of socialist activity from the Progressive Era. So like when I lived in North Dakota, they have a state bank and a state mill. Why do they have those? Because in the early part of the 20th century, socialists and socialist adjacent people were interested in sort of creating government structures to do things better than, or in a more fair and just way than private industry could. So they have these institutions in what is now a very red state that are sort of legacies of this Progressive Era socialism.
And it's very interesting to me, at least, because of the states that Hillary needed to win, and presumably the Democratic nominee would need to win next November. These are the very states with this socialist tradition. I am not endorsing Bernie Sanders here, but one of Bernie's cases, one of the arguments in favor of Bernie Sanders is he is electable. Whether there's a sort of residual muscle memory in these places that would make Bernie palatable or not, it remains to be seen. We don't know because we haven't had the opportunity to see that. But there's an interesting dynamic here because Buttigieg, and of course it's in his interest as one of the self-described moderates on the Democratic side, to sort of embrace heartland values that are inherently anti-socialist at some level.
How would you compare Sanders with Debs? What's the points of similarities? What are the points of difference?
Well, that's a good essay question for an exam. I mean, I think the difference, I think a fundamental difference is, and you've already summed that up in Debs's bio, Debs was a union leader who engaged, when he ran for president, it was symbolic. I mean, he gets almost a million votes in two of his elections. Mm-hmm. He breaks 900,000 in 1912 and in 1920. Debs knows he's not going to win.
No, he never gets any electoral votes.
Right. Bernie is a professional politician who self-identifies as a socialist. But he's a professional politician. He's been a mayor, he's been a congressman, he's been a senator. His career has been that of a politician who identifies as a socialist. Debs came from the union movement. He gradually became a socialist through his sort of study of ideology and things, and he went to jail for it.
Multiple times.
This should. If there are any Bernie bros among our listeners, I am not saying Bernie isn't heroic or whatever. But their careers are very different. And as a result, there's a plausible path whereby Bernie Sanders, a self-described socialist, could be the president of the United States in a year's time. That was never true of Eugene V. Debs.
Right.
So how would you compare?
Well, I think you're right that you know, even though Bernie identifies as a democratic socialist and you know, both is and isn't part of the Democratic Party simultaneously, he definitely is a career politician that is working within established frameworks. He's not a revolutionary in any meaningful sense. He might be revolutionary within the political context of the United States, but he's not a revolutionary in the way that Debs was at times.
He's not talking about nationalizing industries and the government seizing the means of production.
Other than healthcare.
Right.
And even then...
Even then, it's more about nationalizing how it's
So thinking about, I think they are in some ways radically different figures. Let's talk about why is Debs in prison in 1920?
Well,
I think that sort of speaks to what happens to socialism.
Yeah, but you mentioned opposition to World War One, and so there's a crackdown against socialists and people perceived as revolutionaries, more importantly, communists, right after the Second World War. But the crackdown actually starts during the First World War.
Yeah.
But it begins even during the First World War.
Mm-hmm.
So on one hand, the Russian Revolution is the obvious turning point, but even prior to that, in part because there was a crackdown across Europe against socialists during that period. There's a nationalist crackdown as a result of the First World War. That metastasizes with the Russian Revolution of 1917.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a fear of communists, and communists and socialists become identified as the same. And to some extent, I mean, earlier today, James Carville called Bernie Sanders a communist. Yeah, there's a spat going on social media that you don't need to get involved in between James Carville, the Clinton, the architect of Clinton's electoral victories, and the Bernie people. But there was a conflation of socialists with communists in the aftermath of the Russian Revolution, and what gets defined as socialist moves, it becomes much more doctrinaire, it moves to the left. On both sides of the Atlantic, and you can be jailed for being a communist. There are the Palmer Raids, as they're called, right after the First World War, and Debs is jailed for being a socialist.
Specifically, I think he's jailed for his stance against the draft.
That's right, yes.
Actually, there are several other socialists. So Victor Burgo, I mentioned earlier, you know, even though he's elected to Congress, they refuse to seat him because of his opposition to the draft and to the war more broadly.
Their argument is, look, this is an international war of the working class. Imperialists are pitting the working class against each other from these various countries.
And it turns out they were right.
They're not wrong, yes.
Yeah, their analysis of the war was, you know, this is a bad war fought for bad purposes that's causing millions of people to lose their lives unnecessarily.
Most of whom are working class.
Right, they're... the interesting thing, I think, about some of the things that are going on in the socialist movement before is sort of this moment where it really does collapse in around the First World War, is a lot of the ideas that the socialist movement is advocating during the Progressive Era actually then become mainstreamed later on. So the idea of like an old age pension, for instance, which was an idea that socialists had been advocating for, you know, is seen as a radical idea when socialists are arguing for it in 1910, 1920. When you know, the New Deal comes around, Social Security gets implemented, it gets labeled a socialist, but it passes. And then if you get to, you know, a couple decades later on, the thing that was labeled a socialist becomes the sort of bedrock of the American promise to its senior citizen population.
Well, and it's the 8-hour day ending.
Yeah,
child labor,
all these things,
all those
that
things
were,
that come out of the Progressive Era, and then to a large extent are institutionalized.
Yeah.
Not universally, but to a large extent during the New Deal. I mean, what you see, and I know you know this, David, is so there's a backlash right after the First World War and right after the Russian Revolution. Then with the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
Americans, or many Americans, start to think, well, maybe socialism isn't all that bad.
Mm-hmm.
And membership of the Communist Party in the United States is at an all-time high in the 1930s.
Mm.
Many people of whom just kind of have a passing relationship with it, but they'll pay for it in the 50s
exactly.
When there's a backlash. But the point being that socialism then comes to be seen as a kind of more acceptable alternative to communism.
Mm.
So people do make a distinction between Bolshevism and socialism in the 1930s. And somebody like Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal, that's... many of those policies were castigated at the time by their opponents as socialist, but criticized from the left as not being socialist enough.
Right.
And Roosevelt's an interesting figure because his critics... will say they'd call him a kind of neoliberal shill, so, you know, adopting these policies to protect capitalism, and to some extent that's true.
That's true.
That's true. But the 30s is a really interesting time. It's, to some extent, the high watermark of socialism in the United States, both because Communist Party membership is at an all-time high, although we shouldn't make the mistake that critics did of conflating communism with socialism, but also socialist ideas were kind of more acceptable and being implemented, or versions of them in policy, in ways they hadn't before. Since, if I can make one example of why, sort of to illustrate socialism in the 1930s, Alexander Hamilton, of all people, there's a brief enthusiasm for him among socialists. Your boy, who's usually associated with capitalism in the United States. There's a biography of him written by Broadus Mitchell, which I might even have here, that basically says Alexander Hamilton is the founding father of socialism in America, Mr. $10 Bill, because he believes in state intervention in the economy. It's not as crazy as you think. If you think about the report on manufacturers and things like that, I mean,
I guess it depends on who's supposed to benefit from the government intervention.
Yeah, and so the two kind of twins in American history from my period that are always kind of, when one's up, the other one's down, are Jefferson and Hamilton. And we normally associate Jefferson, and FDR consciously did this. FDR went to Monticello, FDR erected the Jefferson Memorial, FDR modeled himself on Jefferson. So we normally associate Jefferson, problematically in my view, with the left, and Hamilton with the right, but there was a brief enthusiasm among socialists for Hamilton in the 1930s. Anyway, that's a digression, but a slightly interesting one.
You know, in thinking about what happens, though, to the Socialist Party, I think you're right that there's an interest in leftist ideas generally during the Great Depression. What happens to the Socialist Party after this crackdown in the 1920s? In terms of who they put forward as their candidate? The other really big, notable socialist candidate for president who tops Debs' record of running 5 times, because I think he runs 6 times, is Norman Thomas.
Right.
Who has a very different background.
Yeah, what's his background?
So he's from basically essentially a middle-class background. His father's a Presbyterian minister. He's interested in questions about the social gospel. Goes to Princeton, so he's sort of a well.
Where is he from geographically?
He's from the Midwest. I have to check.
Sorry, That was a genuine question.
And I generally don't know the answer. You can look it up.
I'm googling it while you keep talking.
But the thing about Norman, he really is coming at this from a sort of a religious social gospel angle rather than a labor union angle, the way that Debs was. He's
Marion, Ohio. Yeah,
that's an interesting city. Thinking about Coxey's Army and other things leaving from Marion, Ohio.
So would you say, David, that he comes almost from that? If we really want to trace the lineage back to the Second Great Awakening, almost tradition of American socialism, or is that too?
I think one could make that connection. But one of the things about him and why he's able to sort of survive in a political landscape that is at various points in time very hostile to socialism, it is because he comes across as both very well educated, as not a rabble rouser, bomb launching kind of guy. He's a minister who's wearing a 3-piece suit, who sounds reasoned in his critique of capitalism.
A bit like the historian Charles Beard, who's roughly contemporaneous.
Yes, Thomas spent a decent amount of time in New York, so they probably rolled rum shoulders with each other at least at some point.
And Beard was from Indiana originally, so another Midwestern. But
connections come out. Thomas, Debs was a pacifist. He was opposed to U.S. entry into World War II. He was opposed to the Japanese American internment. But he's able to, as a socialist, be able to be presentable in mainstream political venues, in part because his version of what socialism was and his sort of physical presentation and personal presentation were didn't comport with people's radical ideas of what an offensive socialist would be. He didn't look like a communist. He didn't act like a communist. He acted like a
Presbyterian
minister.
Whereas Debs came from this union background from an age when union and capital actually tried to kill each other.
Capital
did more killing than the union.
Well, but of the era of the Haymarket riot and other kinds of things. So Norman Thomas is clearly not that. He's sort of a, you know, the Mr. Rogers of the socialist movement.
Interesting. And there's a brief moment during the Second World War. So Americans are thinking leftward or left curious during the 1930s. But then, of course, during the Second World War with the alliance with the Soviet Union, there's a brief moment when the United States and the Soviet Union and the Western powers and the Soviet Union are as one against fascism when, before the Cold War starts, of course, when that there's a kind of, and that would have helped Thomas too, probably, even despite his opposition, not opposition to the war, but his pacifism in response to the war. I guess that's opposition. But all that's going to change with the advent of the Cold War in the 1950s. And so there's a turn to the right. There are the McCarthyite, there are the Red Scares, there's McCarthyism and so on. And what emerges then is, I think, where we are now. So you get, and this is the context against which Bernie is pushing, the Democratic Party in the United States, as the party of the center left, embraces a version of liberalism, really with a large L, that is left of center. It's looking at some of the developments, the emergence of national health programs in Western Europe, for example, but as a way to forestall communism. So they say it's very Rooseveltian. We have to embrace reform on the left in order to prevent a communist revolution or our conquest by going where.
Sure.
And whereas the Republicans, as the party of the then center right, are more committed to just straight anti-communism and anything that smacks of communism. And so we see the two parties on this question of socialism kind of staking their claim. And we see this, I think, to this very day in between the Democratic candidates. You have those of the center left, like Pete Buttigieg, Joe Biden, for example, Amy Klobuchar, who are saying, yes, we believe in sort of government programs that are kind of, we would say, conventionally left of center now.
Yes.
And then we've got Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, who are further to the left. Whether they're actually bona fide socialists, we were talking about this on before we went on the air, is debatable. But that's the cleavage. Whereas the Republicans are going to call them all socialists because it works well. And socialists and communists, are, ever since the 50s and McCarthyism, we're back to being conflated.
Yes, too short. So the and distinction you call everybody a socialist if you don't like what they're saying.
Right. Whereas in the 1930s, people made a distinction between socialists and communists.
Yeah.
That sophisticated reading is gone.
The distinction between Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders is interesting because on the one hand, I don't think they're actually radically far apart in most policy questions. But on the other hand,
I had an argument with a Corbyn supporter the other day about this, who insisted that Elizabeth Warren basically was a liberal shill and a sellout, and Bernie was the only legitimate socialist.
There are purity tests, everywhere.
Yeah. But they're
at least within the same ballpark.
Yeah.
But she, when asked, "Are you a social?" You know, because as Bernie has identified as a socialist consistently for his entire political life, which is half a century old now. You know, she has consistently said, "No, I'm not a socialist. I'm a capitalist." You know, and is very much in the, despite the fact that she and Bernie are not that far apart policy wise, they identify in very different ways. You know, one of the things I think that's happening is that you know, for most of the middle of the 20th century, socialist was such a bad word in the United States, and being identified with anything remotely socialist was political and career suicide, whether you were in Hollywood, whether you were, you know, in a political career, or pretty much anything. I think I had to sign something when I took a job once in the United States that said I wasn't a socialist or a communist to gain employment. I'm not sure I actually signed it, but I think I was supposed to. One of the things I think may be happening now, and this sort of speaks to the popularity of Bernie Sanders among younger voting age Americans, and of some younger members of Congress right now, is that people who are coming of age after the end of the Cold War don't have the same negative associations with the word socialist that their parents did.
I think you're absolutely right. They don't get communist as an epithet, let alone socialist.
Hmm.
And you see this, and it's people under 40 who are Bernie's most passionate supporters. And so they don't have a memory of the Cold War. They certainly don't have a memory of the 50s and 60s.
Sure.
I think you're absolutely right. I think because of that, socialist as an epithet, you know, when they hear socialized medicine, they think, sure, I'll have that, as opposed to their parents and grandparents who, when they, you know, socialized medicine is a code word for socialism or communism, and with all the negative associations that, well, they date beyond the 50s, but they really became kind of hardwired into American culture and politics in the 50s with McCarthyism.
So when James Carville is attacking people, saying that they're socialists and that's not going to work, is that true only for voters of his age?
Well, we don't know. I think James Carville is identifying himself as an old man. In fact, he said communist this morning. He said
communist,
which is very interesting for a Democrat to use communist as an epithet. Well, what wasn't interesting in the 60s or 70s, but it was just, he seems like a grumpy old man. That's, the answer is we don't know, David. We honestly don't know whether this is a liability for Bernie or not. He got 13 million votes last time in 2016 in the election.
Yeah.
Now, that was from the Democratic electorate. We don't know how this plays with the general electorate. I think there's it's a fascinating moment. It's a shame there's so much at stake.
Yes.
Because we can't get this wrong. On one hand, my view is, the Republicans or Trump, and certainly the Koch brothers and the people who are sponsoring, giving big money to PACs, who think everybody who's not a Republican is a communist, are going to use socialist and communist as epithets anyway. They're going to call Joe Biden a socialist.
Which is laughable.
Right, but they are. I mean, they called Obama a socialist.
Yes, they did.
So to some extent, I'm not sure it matters whether the Democrats nominate. I'm not sure the electoral risk is that great whether they nominate Bernie or nominate Biden, because they're both going to be called socialists, and for some voters, or some voters will believe that.
Mm.
But I don't think those voters are up for grabs for the Democrat anyway.
Probably not.
But
given this sort of demographic shift and this sort of generational shift, is there a future for socialism? Yeah. So if Werner Sombart was asking why is there no socialism in America, was he just a century too early? Is there a future for socialism as at least an identifier and a label?
Well, if his explanation, roast beef and apple pie, was true a century or so ago, or 114 years ago, it may not be true now. I mean, by the measures of social mobility, it turns out that a lot of Western, the Nordic countries, which we associate with socialism, have more social mobility than the United States does
at
the moment.
Yeah. Because they have socialism.
Well, yes, by some measures. And so if what we have is a frustrated working class seeking to, that's agitated, we might have the conditions a century later in the United States now for socialism. Plus, because the Cold War is over, as you said, the term itself isn't associated with the kind of opprobrium it once was. We have proved repeatedly on this podcast that we're terrible prognosticators.
We're just not right yet. We're not good at this.
I would take slight exception with Sombart in the sense that I think there was socialism in the United States when he was writing. I think there was a prehistory of socialism in the generation before that. And I think, he was writing at the very time, as I said, that Upton Sinclair, a socialist, was writing, published in The Jungle. Which was an incredibly important socialist novel in the United States and a muckraking novel. He was writing at the same time that Eugene Debs was getting hundreds of thousands of people to vote for him for president. So there was socialism in the United States. It just wasn't as successful as it was in Western Europe at the time. But it remains to be seen what will happen in coming years.
All right. I guess it's time for last drops. What you got?
I want to endorse Alexis Coe's new biography of George Washington.
Okay.
You Never Forget Your First. It's a wonderful title. I've met Alexis once, and I've corresponded with her, and I read one of the chapters in manuscript. It was a great privilege. Alexis is the first woman to write a full-scale biography of George Washington, which is a little bit surprising. But it's a very fine book. She writes with real brio. Well, yes, she is. Now, other women, of course, have written about Washington. In fact, Flora Fraser, who won the Washington Book Prize a few years ago, wrote a really wonderful book about George and Martha Washington. And Alexis knows about the scholarship produced by other women. She's not making this grand claim, but it's the first full-scale biography written of Washington written by a woman. I'm writing a book about Washington at the moment, so I'm particularly interested in this, and I can give it 2 thumbs up in my hearty endorsement. And she writes really well and writes with real verve and brio. And she's done her homework. She knows the sources. So yeah.
And what's her take on how is her Washington different than everybody else's Washington?
He's less staid. He's more. I mean, I think she gets his. Again, somebody who's working on Washington himself at the moment. She gets his personality and his struggle to control his temper. He's a passionate guy. It's worth a read.
All right.
Yeah. And it's not worth a read only because she's the first woman to write about Washington. Yeah. It's worth a read.
It sounds like her Washington's different than the Washington biography you probably have on your shelf.
Yes, and she also was I think she was the producer, or she was deeply involved in the documentary that's about to come out on the History Channel on Washington.
Oh, cool.
As well. So anyway.
Neat.
You never forget your first.
Never.
It's Valentine's Day, David. You never forget your first. Yeah. Okay. As far as titles go, that's a very good title.
Yeah, that's a good title.
Titles are important. What do you have for us, David?
I'm going to endorse 2 books which came out early this week on the same day, so they're sort of book twins. The first is Megan Kate Nelson's The Three-Cornered War, which is these are both Civil War books. Megan Kate Nelson is looking at the war in the West and the ways in which the Civil War is not just between Union and Confederates, but there are Native Americans also involved, and hence the Three-Cornered War title. It's sort of a group biography of a dozen or so important figures in the West, and she's really an extraordinarily gifted writer who's thinking about writing history in new and interesting ways, and so I want to recommend The Three-Cornered War. I also want to recommend Adam Dombey's The False Cause, which is about... The Lost Cause is this sort of mythology that former Confederates and Confederate sympathizers develop in the century and a half after the Civil War that valorizes Robert E. Lee and what have you. What Adam does in this book is point out the ways in which the False Cause actually, the Lost Cause created and continues to create historical fiction to support their claims about what the Confederacy was about. So he's got things about people who are claiming to be the eldest Confederate veteran when it turns out they didn't fight for the Confederacy at all because they really want... So, in fact, he has, like, this one point where there's a convention of former Confederate soldiers who are all over 100. Turns out none of them actually fought for the Confederacy.
That's why they lived to be 100.
Exactly. You know, they're all lying about who they were and their ages and stuff, and about sort of, you know, the ways in which the memory of the Civil War is not only, you know, distorted but actually fabricated, and how it fits in with monuments and all these other kinds.
Does it happen on, I mean, this might not be his concern, does it happen on both sides? Do you get Union?
He's really concerned with this as well. He's really concerned with the Confederate fictions, because I think they have to bend over backwards more to sort of create these kinds of false narratives, right? About, you know, there's all these things about slaves fighting for the Confederacy, and he sort of that's sort of a myth that actually is only a relatively recent myth that's been developed, and so he's looking at that. There's also another actual book that just came out about on that topic, so this is an interesting time to think about it, you know, given the recent fights over monuments in particular, so even some that have happened this week, right, that Adam talks about. So it's a really, really great book.
Great. Excellent. All right, David.
Cheers.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at WhiskeyRebelPod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.